Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay.
The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Unless there is any more question, we have to find an argument in this case.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention.
Welcome to Divided Argument, an unscheduled, unpredictable Supreme Court podcast. I'm Dan Epps.
And I'm Will Bode. Dan, they finally ran out of boring opinions.
Yeah, we were having a good run. Although they did manage to get one boring-ish opinion out today. We're recording this on Monday, June 21st, reacting to the court's Monday dump of three opinions, only two of which we're going to talk about. I think one of them, Goldman Sachs Group versus Arkansas Teacher Retirement System, is not like the most boring case ever, but it's a securities fraud class action case and one on which we don't have a ton to say. But the other two are pretty good. We've got this NCAA case, which is about college athletes and antitrust law. And then we've got U.S. versus Arthrex, which I bet is that's one you've been waiting for, I bet, Will.
I have. And I got to say, this is tough for me. So this is, I mentioned this on a previous episode. I've been for the past 2 years, actually, trying to work on a paper about severability doctrine and what courts actually do when they find statutes unconstitutional. And this is one of three cases that were pending this term about severability doctrine. The ACA case, which was about last week, was another one where the court didn't really get into it. And here, the court got into it. And I got to say, you know, I'm still like, so a part of my brain is still trying to like work out, you know, how work it all out in kind of the long term, 100-page article that you'll see in 8 months, hopefully.
Does this kill your article?
Nothing kills my article, Stan.
Well,
being an originalist means never having to say you're wrong because the Supreme Court said so.
Well, that's possibly true, but they can make it harder for you to write your article, at least.
So we'll get there. But I'll just say, yeah. So I'm really thinking this through. I may well say some things here that I regret and have to take back in print later. But
what makes this different than any other episode?
Usually, I don't care if I get anything wrong.
Okay, so. As you said, this case involves severability, but it also involves a kind of meaty substantive constitutional law question. So this is a case about the Appointments Clause, and it's about these administrative patent judges. They participate in these proceedings. This is something the court has dealt with a few times already. This procedure called inter partes review, which is something that, as I understand it, does not have a long historical pedigree. It's something that was created in this statute called the America Invents Act. And it's a way that after a patent is issued, someone can go to the patent, what's it called?
Trial and Appeal Board.
Yeah, the Patent Trial and Appeal Board.
PTAB.
And say, this is a bad patent. Can you guys, you know, take another look at this? And there's kind of like a little mini trial that happens where they determine whether the patent is invalid.
Right. So patent law is neither of our area of expertise, I think, as much as some of these other parts of the opinion. But, you know, as I understand it, when you apply for a patent, you know, there's not a ton of scrutiny. Like, I mean, you can have your application denied, but you can have your application granted without it necessarily being a super good patent. Which can cause a lot of problems later in litigation, and litigation is expensive. So we have this extra procedure, the sort of like, oops, we goofed procedure.
So it's like, it's simpler than having to go to court and doing a, you know, maybe getting sued for infringement or going to get some kind of declaratory judgment or something like that. This is designed to be a little bit more streamlined.
Yeah. And this was controversial, and the Supreme Court upheld it against a separation of powers / due process challenge in a case called Oil States, where Justice Gorsuch dissented, and he's still mad about it, as we'll talk about in a few minutes.
And that was like an Article 3 issue, right?
I think it was formally an Article 3 issue, although the Article 3 issues and the sort of due process issues blend together, because there's a way in which a patent is a property right. And normally, once you have a piece of property, you know, even if there was something a little goofy in the way you got the piece of property, we don't come in 10 years later and say, like, oops, sorry, we're taking your house back. But we're taking your patent back.
It's constitutional in that way, but now we have a different constitutional challenge in this case to the inter partes review system. And specifically, it's about the way in which these judges, these administrative
so-called
patent
judges
work.
So-called judges.
Okay, yeah. This relates to a whole Twitter exchange you and I were on a week or two ago about who gets to be called judges when you're talking about the federal government, what's a federal judge. But yeah, these are people within the Patent and Trademark Office, and their title is administrative patent judges. They're appointed by the Secretary of Commerce, but they have, you know, limitations on their removal, so they can't just be fired at will. And their decisions in these inter partes review cases are final.
Right. So there are four levels going on here, as far as I can tell. So there's the president. He's the top. We all agree he's the top. Then there's the Secretary of Commerce, who's appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. Then we've got the director of the agency, who's like the next level down from the secretary. And then we've got these APJs, the administrative patent judges, who are also appointed by the secretary and are in some sense inferior to the director, but not totally accountable to the director. Right.
So the director, because he can't just say, hey, I didn't like this decision, go do it all over again. He can do other stuff, like he can initiate like a rehearing, or they can initiate a rehearing, and then he gets to decide who sits on the rehearing, and he can like strip these judges of the ability to hear cases in the future. But he does
put
not
himself
have,
on the rehearing panel. So if he really wanted, if they granted a rehearing and then he put himself on the panel and found one guy who agreed with him, and it's better than being a chief judge, but it still is not like
Total he's control. Got some workarounds. Right. The one person you didn't mention in your, you know, hierarchy is the marshal of the Supreme Court, who, as I understand it, kind of sits above the president, of course, with the ability to initiate secret impeachments that happen in the Supreme Court basement. But we don't need to get into
that. That's a secret episode only for our Patreons.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That is not for general consumption. Okay. And why would this be a problem? So you've got this hierarchy. You've got these administrative patent judges. They get to make these decisions. Canceling a patent. I mean, we've got cancel culture all the time. Now we're canceling patents left and right. So why is that a problem constitutionally? Potentially.
Okay. So because of the separation of powers and because of two sort of related rules that the majority is not super clear on how these two rules interact. But so one is the appointments clause. Appointments clause sets up how officers get appointed. And it says that top line officers, most officers or some set of officers, have to be appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And then a smaller set, so-called inferior officers, don't. They can be appointed separately, like by the heads of departments, so by the Secretary of Commerce. So that's how the APJs were appointed. They're appointed in the way that only inferior officers can be appointed. And so then there's a question, is what they're doing consistent with being a so-called inferior officer or not?
Okay. And so this should be an easy case because Supreme Court in, you know, decades of case law has given us a super, super clear test on what an inferior officer versus a principal officer is, right?
Indeed, it is not. I believe it has given us at least two tests, one of which is in the case Morrison versus Olson, where the Supreme Court upheld the special prosecutor as an inferior officer. That special prosecutor is appointed by a special court in D.C. And a second case is a case called Edmund versus United States, where the court upheld a set of military judges as inferior officers under a very different test. And I believe Justice Thomas says, and that this, it raised my eyebrows for a second, although I think he's right, this is the first time the court's ever said that there's an inferior officer problem. It's the first time they've ever said, that there's a problem with somebody being characterized as an inferior officer. So this is crossing an important line.
And it's sort of, there have been other cases where the court has said, we think this person is a principal officer, right? But they kind of aren't super clear on exactly why.
Yeah, well, I think so. But I'll just say, so one of the things the dissent floats, and we're getting ahead of ourselves, is it's not clear, it's really not clear whether this inferior officer category is supposed to be really big or really small. So it's only triggered when Congress decides to take somebody outside of the default appointments process, president and Senate confirmation, and move them to the inferior category. So it's only really triggered when Congress sort of tries to trigger it. So there are a ton of people in the government who are Senate confirmed, for whom we don't really know if Congress wanted to get rid of Senate confirmation, could they?
Because it does, you can always go above and beyond, right? You can say,
stick to the Senate confirmation if you don't have to.
Yeah. Now, in theory, there's also this third category of people who are just kind of employees who are not officers of the United States, although I understand it, there's maybe some disagreement about how large that category should be, or maybe even whether that category exists.
There is some disagreement with that, and the court does have more precedent about that category, and at least a general test that if you exercise significant authority on behalf of the United States and are more than just a contractor, you fall into that category. And everybody here agrees we're not in we're in the officer category. These people have to be appointed somehow, and the question is, how can they be appointed and what can they do? So the second piece of this, just to bring it in, is the executive power clause. So Article 2 vests the executive power in the President of the United States, and that's the only person mentioned in the vesting clause. Now, of course, there are tons and tons and tons and tons of other people in the executive branch who exercise executive power. But the fact that in sort of like an ultimate sense, the power all started with the president and had to be almost like deeded out separately to everybody else in the executive branch creates a set of separate problem. What the Supreme Court has said in a bunch of opinions, you know, means there has to be a certain kind of accountability, a certain kind of traceability, because anybody exercising executive power is ultimately doing it in the president's name. So we need to check whether these APJs are too far removed from the buck stops here.
Yeah, and these two issues tend to travel together because it's sort of one is about the front end. How do these people get into the office? And the other is about the back end. Basically, really comes down to can they be fired, right? And by whom?
Partly. So this is not always, and this is a good case about it. So most of the time we have the second question. It's in a can they be fired case. It's Congress has said somebody can only be fired for cause, and then the question is that constitutional? But it's not necessarily the only piece of it, because after all, even if you could fire somebody, there would still be the question about, like, can you undo their decision? Like, what if somebody had the power to make final decisions on behalf of the United States, but they could be fired? Before you caught them, they bought Greenland or something else that was like a big deal.
It can't be undone.
So the court usually ignores the second part. They usually ignore the kind of the supervision requirement. But in this case, that's part of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think maybe a lot of times you just assume that if someone serves at the pleasure of some other officer, that's like basically the power to direct that person. But I guess there is the concern that someone could kind of do something they're not supposed to do and then bind the U.S. in some permanent way.
Right. And the question is, you could think, yes, technically they can do that, but the threat of being fired means they almost never will do that. You could think technically they can't do that. It just doesn't come up very often. You could think, as Gary Lawson once wrote, this is why the obsession with the power to fire people is like not necessarily the right thing for formalists to focus on, because it's like both broader than necessary and narrower than necessary. What we really care about is, you know, control. So all those different things are going on here. And that's part of why I find this a confusing case. Like, in a way, the core question, do these APJs have too much discretion that places them, you know, insulates them too much from politics, is an easy question to answer. But in a way, all the moving parts about how much is it from different versions of the statute and how much these different clauses interact makes my head hurt. And to be honest, I think they made the Chief Justice's head hurt too.
Yeah. And it also kind of affects what you think the right solution is, what the right remedy is. And we'll get to that in a second. Maybe it makes sense for us to kind of go through the arguments on both sides about the kind of merits issue and then circle back to remedy severability. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. We've laid out those two kind of potential issues, the kind of front end appointment and then the kind of supervision point. And as we said, these administrative patent judges, who I'm going to call APJs, consistent with how the opinion refers to them, makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about. And we do decide there's a problem there. The majority opinion by Chief Justice Roberts decides there is a problem there. Where is it?
Good question. I'm not sure we know exactly. Here's the way the majority puts it. The majority puts it that the nature of their responsibilities is not consistent with their method of appointment. So I'm not sure the majority actually takes a position about this, but either the APJs are inferior officers, and therefore they can't issue unreviewable decisions. Or the APJs issue unreviewable decisions, therefore they can't be inferior officers. But either way, the point is they were appointed as inferior officers in the bottom category, and they're now issuing decisions that can't be reviewed by anybody else. Those two things together are not okay.
Yeah, there's this interesting part where the majority, which I guess it's not the majority, at this moment, or is it still the majority?
It's the end of part two.
into part two. Okay, so we still have the majority because Justice Gorsuch kind of steps off for part three of the opinion. But at the end of the part that's the majority, the court says, the principal dissent, which is the opinion by Justice Thomas, repeatedly charges that we never say whether the APJs are principal officers who are not appointed in the manner required by the Appointments Clause, or instead inferior officers exceeding the permissible scope of their duties under that clause. Okay, and you'd think the next sentence would be, okay, here's the answer. Instead, the court says, but both formulations describe the same constitutional violation. Only an officer properly appointed to a principal office may issue a final decision binding the executive branch in the proceeding before us.
Yeah.
So not going to tell us which of those exactly is the problem, but either way, it's a problem, unconstitutional, it needs to be fixed in some way.
Yeah. So I actually think this part is great. I mean, when thinking about the constitutional step, separating out the Appointments Clause inquiry and the sort of Executive Power Clause inquiry is weirdly artificial. And now the court does that artificial inquiry sometimes, but in some ways it seems clearer and more helpful to just say, you know, these two things together create a problem. So we can imagine multiple ways you could structure the agency that would work out, appoint them differently, or give them different powers, but this combination is a problem.
Now, yeah, so
the lack of clarity is going to be a big problem when we talk about the remedy or severability in a second. But for the merits,
it's okay to have them appointed by the head of the department. It's okay to have them somewhat insulated, but you can't do both. Is that?
Yeah,
okay to have them not supervised directly by the secretary, but you can't do both.
Right. If they are principal officers, they don't need a supervisor, and if they're in, exactly.
They don't need a supervisor who's not the president. So could they still be insulated from for-cause removal by the president at that point? Or that would be kind of controversial, right?
Under current precedent, you can have one layer of for-cause removal. That's Humphrey's executor.
Yeah.
Now Humphrey's executor is controversial.
Yeah. Is that true for all duties, but is that true for all possible duties that the principal officer could perform, or
depends on which precedent you look at.
So basically that's the problem. And let's circle back in a second to how we're gonna fix it. I think we're gonna skip over Justice Gorsuch's concurring opinion for the moment, but we're gonna come back to it. And I think we will go on to what the majority calls the principal dissent, which is Justice Thomas's opinion. Here, I think I would say Justice Breyer, looking at this from kind of a higher, kind of 10,000 feet up, makes a pretty interesting argument for kind of constitutional flexibility. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, the founders laid out the Constitution. They didn't resolve a lot of specific questions. He says something interesting. He says on page 6, he says, the Constitution is not a detailed tax code. And for good reason, the nation's desires and needs change, sometimes over long periods of time. The 19th century, the judiciary may not have foreseen the changes that produced the New Deal. We can't foresee everything that's going to happen. But basically, this is kind of a strong and interesting argument for not treating the Constitution as sort of super, super formally binding and in providing a lot of details, a little bit room for flexibility, letting Congress kind of make appropriate determinations about the right way to kind of divvy up executive power and so forth.
Yeah. So two things I think are interesting about this. So one, Justice Breyer has been in dissent in a lot of the court's recent separation of powers cases. And the court's had a more formalist approach in these other executive power cases and judicial power cases. And Justice Breyer has been in dissent in a lot of them. So I think he's sort of bringing that together and saying, look, we're way too involved in this at this point. We're second guessing way too many sort of separation of powers structural choices. And I do wonder, do you think the case, I mean, I know you and I both believe that the court needs to be pretty deferential to democratic choices. We worry about judicial activism. Do you think the case for that kind of deference is stronger or weaker in the separation of powers context? Like, I could imagine saying to Justice Breyer, look, when the question is like substantive power, can Congress regulate healthcare? Yes, broad deference. Maybe even when the question is individual rights, like does this new regulation, you know, violate free speech somehow or violate due process somehow? Deference. But we're just thinking about the kind of like the nuts and bolts of like the mechanics. Do we still need deference, or is that a place where it actually makes more sense to have a clear rule?
You know, I think it maybe depends on the specific separation of powers context we're talking about. And I think that there's some areas like the independent counsel statute where, you know, you can make a good argument that there's real kind of dangers to democracy by having these, you know, basically independent counsels who are appointed. This is, you know, what comes up in Morrison versus Olson, who have this huge amount of power and can basically determine their own budgets and just investigate forever and bring charges and so forth. And that does seem a little bit troubling. And we've seen some situations where that seems like it led to troubling and possibly anti-democratic results. Case like this, I don't know, I'm a little bit less concerned about it. And maybe there's a difference between kind of, you know, and somewhere in here, I think it's Justice Breyer says something about this, that there's maybe a difference between these kinds of situations where, you know, kind of one branch is aggrandizing itself at the expense of another versus just a situation where we're talking about how are we going to lay out kind of different kinds of authority within the executive branch rather than this isn't really kind of Congress totally hobbling the executive. And the other thing is, you know, there is this strain in these separation of powers cases among the kind of more formalist justices where they kind of extol the virtues of political accountability in terms of following the separation of powers. That doesn't do a lot for me because the president has a lot of things on his plate and voters have a lot of things to focus on. And I am not convinced that there's ultimately that much political accountability even in a world where there's kind of direct presidential control over these decisions.
You don't think we're going to see a lot of 2024 campaign ads about Biden's lack of control over the PTAB?
There's a lot in American politics that has surprised me over the last few years. So I'm willing to believe anything. But, you know, I do think that with the sprawling executive state and one president and, you know, one election every 4 years, I don't see a huge case that there's a lot of accountability happening either way. And then for me, it kind of comes down to kind of some matter of good government concerns. I mean, with respect to this kind of here, I don't have strong priors about like what the best arrangement is. The thing that I worry about is the kind of slippery slopes where all of a sudden we say this the civil service is now unconstitutional, which I think would be really bad.
The slippery slope you should be worrying about here, I think, is not the civil service, but is the Social Security Administration and maybe the immigration judges. Because I do think the one branch we haven't talked about much yet is the judiciary. But the one thing you could worry about is the court has said, okay, we can take these cases out of the judiciary, even though they're kind of cases. But you might think it would be good to have a doctrine that says, look, if you take them out of the judiciary, you got to keep them in the executive branch. And what Congress is trying to do here is to kind of create a JV judiciary, like some people who are sufficiently insulated from the executive branch that they're not too executive, and we even call them judges, but they're not the actual judges we have. And that, I mean, maybe here that's fine. Maybe we don't like our judges right now or something, but that is the sort of the one real concern I have is the kind of the creation of the JV judiciary.
Yeah. And actually there's some push to make them more of a JV judiciary. I was talking to my colleague, administrative law expert extraordinaire Ron Levin the other day, and he was saying a lot of administrative law judges have been pushing for kind of moving all ALJs into kind of their own agency, give them more prestige. Yeah, which would be interesting. I think that, you know, would probably create a whole new mess of potential constitutional problems. But yeah, there's things to be concerned about there for sure.
The court never says it, but that might be the one sort of like substantive concern that explains some of this. Okay. What about Justice Thomas?
Okay. Justice Thomas, I thought this was, and maybe tell me if you disagree with this. I mean, I thought this was, this didn't read like a totally classic Justice Thomas opinion to me. It had sort of a little bit more of kind of like a functional, pragmatic kind of common sense flavor to it than a typical Justice Thomas opinion. Now, he does do a fair bit of originalism and history along the way, but he, you know, he gets into kind of like more practical stuff. He talks about like the org chart in the executive branch and the PTO, and he talks about the kind of practical ways in which the director of the PTO can, you know, supervise these administrative patent judges. I don't know. Did it seem?
I love this dissent, but okay. No, people forget, I think, that Justice Thomas is also, in addition to being a really good originalist, he's also just a really good sort of doctrinal lawyer, maybe because he often does the originalist thing. But yeah, here, part of what he's doing is taking the court's previous cases, which did not provide much resolution here, and showing the ways in which the majority is both sort of going beyond what the previous cases had said, and then also opening a lot of new questions. I do like the part that the majority says the dissent, you know, tries to attack us on the precedent, but we feel like their heart's not really in it, which may be a version of your observation.
Yeah. And just one other thing to note before we get into it more is, and this is effectively kind of a 5-4 case on the key constitutional issue. The three who joined Justice Thomas are liberal justices, Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So pretty interesting breakdown here.
And in terms of assignments, so if the initial lineup is 5-4, do we think the dissent assignments work the same way as the majority opinion? Like Justice Thomas says, I'm going to assign myself the principal dissent, or is it more of
Typically they do.
Yeah. I wonder what Justice Breyer thought when Justice Thomas sent around a memo saying, I'm taking the dissent.
Maybe thought, let's wait and see if we can join this. And
yeah.
But then he wrote something that the liberals who, you know, have pretty different mythological approaches were pretty comfortable joining, I guess.
Yeah. It has an originalist thing at the end.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah. It doesn't.
So here's the, I actually just thought the most helpful thing is on page 13 of the Thomas dissent, where Justice Thomas talks about line drawing problems. And he says, look, interpreting the appointments clause to bar any non-principal officer from taking final action poses serious line drawing problems.
Yeah, this is really important.
The majority assures that not every decision by an inferior officer must be reviewable, but this sparks more questions than it answers. One, can a line prosecutor offer a plea deal without sign-off from a principal officer? Two, if faced with a life-threatening scenario, can an FBI agent use deadly force to subdue a suspect? Three, or if an inferior officer temporarily fills a vacant office tasked with making final decisions, do those decisions violate the appointments clause? And are the courts around the country supposed to sort through lists of each officer's or employee's duties, categorize each one as principal or inferior, and then excise any that look problematic?
And I was thinking about the line prosecutor example as I was reading the majority. I was really glad that he flagged that.
Yeah. What is the answer, by the way?
I don't know. I mean,
if it's problematic for the PTAB to make a decision about a patent without the final review of the director, surely the same thing has to be true for a line prosecutor, you know, giving somebody a sweetheart deal without.
Well, I guess the thing I don't know is whether that actually comes up in practice, or whether there has to be sort of formal sign off by United States attorneys before something can be entered into binding the office.
Mm-hmm. What about if it's less formal? Like, I do think it happens that the line attorney might just show up in court and like not raise an argument. You show up in court for sentencing.
Yeah.
The defense attorney say, we'd like a below guideline sentence. And the line attorney says, I can't formally agree, but makes sense to us.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting because you are kind of forfeiting an argument, basically.
Can the U.S. attorney learn about argument. That the next day, like march back into court and say, no, throw the book at him, judge.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that seems problematic.
And the third of these, the bit about the acting officer, came up a lot recently. I don't know if you remember a few years ago when everybody lost their minds when Matthew Whitaker was the acting attorney general.
Oh, yeah. That was a little wacky.
But this is actually that, you know, that issue as well.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could draw a distinction between, like, there are situations where someone just de facto is able to make final decisions versus situations where the law actually like contemplates that they will. So like with the line prosecutor, I mean, they're supposed to follow the instructions of the U.S. attorney. And if the U.S. attorney says, I don't want you making any plea deals or forfeiting any arguments without me, even if they go ahead and do it, and then, you know, that's bad, but there's not necessarily like a separation of powers violation versus a system that says, no, line prosecutors, they get to make the frontline decision and their decisions may never be challenged by the U.S. attorney. That seems like maybe you could say that's more problematic.
Although if that's right, which side of the line does this case fall on? Because after all, the director has all these abilities ex ante to give directions to the APJs, and then he has a bunch of like their decisions aren't exactly final for the reasons we talked about. He has all these quasi workarounds.
But the scheme does not seem to contemplate that he's going to dictate to them in advance, here's what you should do in this inter partes review, right?
No, he can set policies for them to. I mean, the government kept insisting. This gives us one of the other parts of the majority opinion I liked, where they acknowledge all these sort of things the director can do to sort of influence inter partes review as a substitute for actually reviewing it. And they say at page 12, that is not the solution. It is the problem. Even if the director succeeds in procuring his preferred outcome, such machinations blur the lines of accountability demanded by the appointments clause.
Yeah, and I thought there was something to that.
Yeah, it just makes me think back to the prosecutors, the same things. Like we'd say, look, the line attorney is the, I mean, it's the person on the line exercising power. There may be some machinations that let their supervisor keep them in line, but if it's a problem here.
Yeah. But I mean, in any situation, like someone who's inferior to someone else can always kind of go against the, you can't like be there. Like the U.S. attorney can't like be there in court with them at every moment. Kind of like there's just too many people to supervise. So I still think there might be something to that distinction, but we got a lot more to talk about. So could we just, before we go, we do need to go on to severability. Could we just quickly talk about part four where he, Justice Thomas kind of goes through different kind of understandings of the kind of principal inferior officer distinction from history. Do you understand all those?
Right. So Justice Thomas just says, look, we might at some point need to figure out what inferior officers really means and look to history to figure it out. One possibility is that it's a really narrow category. And he pulls up a little bit on a discussion from James Madison at the Constitutional Convention, in which everybody has to fall into the category of either a superior officer or an inferior officer. The second possibility, which I think the more interesting one, and I've heard voiced occasionally by a few friends of the show, but I've never seen somebody like Justice Thomas endorse it, is maybe inferior officers encompasses nearly everybody. Maybe even the heads of departments are inferior officers in the sense that they're inferior to the president. So maybe what the Constitution really means is everybody other than the specifically named people in the Constitution, ambassadors and public ministers, maybe they all in theory could be inferior. Like if Congress wanted to let the president appoint his own cabinet, they could. And Justice Thomas even says the constitutional text and history provides some support for this rationale. And he goes through a possible reading of it. This is where I have to note, as far as I know, the Supreme Court has never actually said that federal judges are not inferior officers. It's a general assumption that they're not. And there's a footnote in a case where the court notes that it's a general assumption that they're not. But this is like below the Supreme Court. But there's actually a not crazy textual and historical argument that at least lower court judges could be appointed by the president directly.
You mean by the Supreme Court? Because they are appointed by the president directly.
Right? Without the Senate.
Oh, interesting. Could they be appointed by the Supreme Court justices?
Maybe, yeah. Okay. Courts of law, yeah. And of course, we do this with magistrate.
Yeah.
Some people call them judges. Magistrates are appointed by the district courts. So they must be, that's under the theory they're inferior officers.
And bankruptcy judges are appointed by the circuit, right?
I forget, but same thing. Yeah. So the theory is they're inferior officers.
Yeah.
So what about a district judge? Anyway, and then does he have a third possible test as well? I think he does.
Yeah, he does. But then I had trouble figuring out. I saw two, but then I was trying to figure out where the third one was. So, but we're not going to resolve that in this case today.
Good law review article right there.
Probably will produce more than one from various people trying to flesh this out. But we do have, for better or for worse, we do have 5 votes for this being a constitutional violation. Justice Thomas's view on that does not prevail. And so now we come to the question of what to do about it. And then we have a different disagreement on the court, because here the Roberts opinion loses the majority, loses Justice Gorsuch in terms of what the appropriate remedy is, although Breyer agrees on the remedy. So ultimately, so there's, in theory, I think he could have joined that part of the opinion and sort of made it the opinion of the court, but he at least reaches the same conclusion. And so this, the plurality, I guess you'd call it, their remedy is going to prevail. And so their remedy is kind of this narrow surgical excision where they go in and say the solution is that now these decisions on inter partes review by the APJs, now those are going to be reviewable by the director of the PTO.
There's a section of the statute, 6C, that says that only the PTAB can rehear its own decisions. And the court concludes that section 6C cannot constitutionally be enforced to the extent that its requirements prevent the director from reviewing final decisions rendered by APJs. So now their decisions are not final. The director can review them. And then as to these specific parties, they conclude there should be a remand so the director can decide whether to review this patent, which I bet you he will not do.
And if he does, maybe he'll just come out the same way.
Sure.
Okay. And maybe we should look at this through the lens of the Gorsuch, yes, partial dissent, who says, basically takes kind of a more formalist view of severability, sort of building off of some stuff we were talking about in the last episode, although I'm curious to see, you know, where you land on this, and sort of says, look, it's not our job. What the court is doing is basically making like a policy judgment. They're kind of just looking at the scheme, and we don't really know what Congress wanted to do here. We don't have any kind of fallback provision, any kind of severability or inseverability provision. And so the right thing to do is just going to sort of say this scheme is unconstitutional. Congress, fix it. Go back and fix it. And rather than doing this kind of policy-based inquiry, where that basically lets the court rewrite the statute.
That's what he says. That's all good. Although I think he's a little unfair to the majority. So the severability inquiry used to be this kind of policy-based, like what would be the best rule here question. And Justice Gorsuch rightly says, I don't want to do that. And he says we should do the traditional thing we used to do, page 6. When the application of a statute violated the Constitution, courts simply declined to enforce the statute in the case or controversy at hand. So we should just say, statute's not constitutional here, we don't enforce it here, and let somebody else sort out, or let Congress sort out how to fix the statute going forward. The problem that Justice Gorsuch skates over, which he mentions earlier in his dissent, is that there isn't just a statute here that violates the Constitution. Like, nothing violates the Constitution about giving the IPJs unreviewable authority if they're inferior officers or superior officers. Or nothing violates the Constitution about making the APJs inferior officers if they're not unreviewable. So there isn't just a statute that violates the Constitution in the abstract.
But there's a whole scheme, right?
It's a combination of statutes that violate the Constitution in this particular case. And I think the majority is trying to respond to Justice Gorsuch. But they actually don't talk about excision. They don't talk about surgery. They say all we have is the power to disregard an unconstitutional enactment. We give full effect to the statute whenever it's not repugnant to the Constitution. And what they conclude is all we have to do is not give effect to 6C. That's the statutory provision that leads to the constitutional violation in this case. And if we ignore it, it's fine.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although this thing I just want to understand is if we just ignore that provision, is there some kind of default that the director would be able to review the decision? Or are they kind of like imagining a different? Are they actually having to like write a different statutory provision that it grants the director that authority?
They are imagining that's the default because of the nature of executive power.
Yeah.
That absent something taking it away, that the executive would have it. And maybe that's a little creative, but they're imagining that default.
Yeah.
And here's where things get interesting in multiple different ways. So Justice Gorsuch is writing this because he has been, for the past several years, he and Justice Thomas have been sort of waging war on the court's severability doctrine, saying this more formalist approach, we have to just not enforce the statute. What's interesting is Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch disagree here. That happened a little bit in the ACA case last time. It wasn't totally clear because the standing issue was there. But here again, they both sort of in theory have the same approach, and Justice Thomas is going in a different direction. Because as I understand Justice Thomas, and this blends the merits and severability a little bit together, he's taking the majority one further. Justice Thomas would take the majority one better, because he would say, look, if the majority is right, that the only problem here is Section 6C, that the director doesn't have the power to review these things, and that provision's unenforceable, then problem solved. The director actually has the power to review these things. He didn't choose to use it. Nobody asked him to use it, but he has the power. And so there's just been no constitutional violation here at all. Like the problem is in a way self-correcting.
But that's not severability. That's just merits.
They go together. I mean, in a way, and actually this is John Harrison had an amicus brief in this case, which is an amazing amicus brief that kind of was leaning this way. So the Federal Circuit had said there is a constitutional violation and we will cure it by holding these provisions of the statute unconstitutional. And once we hold them unconstitutional, that cures the violation. The point Harrison made, and Justice Thomas is picking it up implicitly a little bit, is like courts don't cure constitutional violations by striking things down. Mm-hmm. The statute's unconstitutional. Yeah. It's unconstitutional. Yeah. It's not enforceable.
Yeah.
You know, the courts might say that, and they might say, look, if the law wasn't applied correctly in your case, you get a remand. But the majority doesn't have the power to fix anything. So if Section 6C was unconstitutional, it was unconstitutional all along, and we can all go home.
But that's different than what Justice Thomas is doing, because he's just saying,
I think he says that in the end. I mean, he thinks you don't even need to strike down Section 6C, but I think he says in the dissent that if the majority were right, they would still be wrong.
That's pretty interesting. I wonder whether this is the last case we're going to see with inter partes review. That was another place where Gorsuch and Thomas disagreed was in oil states. Justice Gorsuch wanted to scrap this whole thing and Justice Thomas was in the majority, as I recall, saying it was fine.
Maybe so. I mean, so it's interesting. So this, it's interesting how these statutes, the ACA, the American Invents Act, both enacted around the same time, I think, just keep giving rise to these series of Supreme Court decisions, kind of trying to wrestle with exactly how it works, whether it's constitutional. This solution creates the next problem. Obviously, the ACA cases are sort of heavily politicized in a way that everybody knows about. And the patent cases, I mean, my friends who are patent law scholars get really worked up about them, but the rest of us just kind of like turn to them and are kind of like, oh, that's interesting. But maybe this just happens whenever Congress enacts a new statute. And since Congress is never going to enact major statutes again.
It's not going to be a problem. The one other thing about this we didn't talk about was Justice Breyer's citation on his quotation on page 7 of Ludwig Wittgenstein. He quotes the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, where he says, sort of at the very end of the Tractatus, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. Oddly, he doesn't give a citation for this. Luckily, this was, you know, as a philosophy major, this is one thing I remembered. He's talking about why the functional approach in separation of powers cases is better. It's more likely to prevent inappropriate judicial interference. It embodies, at least to agree, the philosopher's advice. And then he gives the quote, no citation. We see more, I think, there are not a lot of Wittgenstein citations in law, but I think if you're going to see them, you're more likely to see late citations to the Philosophical Investigations rather than early Wittgenstein to the Tractatus. Wittgenstein apparently, he really kind of changed his views on everything over the course of his quite impressive career. I don't know if Breyer has been reading Wittgenstein, but that should be a good ending of this discussion for us, Will. So whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. So let's go on.
You got it.
Okay. Other one we're going to talk about is National Collegiate Athletic Association v. Alston, the NCAA case. And this is an interesting one. And this is a case that I think could have been divisive on the court. It maybe had the potential, or at least people didn't really know heading in to the case how this might go. It turns out this is a case that produces a lot of unanimity on the court. It's an opinion by Justice Gorsuch. And then we have a quite interesting concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh, which I think is probably more interesting than the majority itself. So this is an antitrust case, a Sherman Act case. Sherman Act is the original antitrust statute. It is a pretty spare statute. It doesn't have a lot of words, but gives courts basically the ability to kind of declare things illegal restraints on trade. And the NCAA is, you know, in a very real sense, a restraint on trade. It's an agreement by a bunch of schools and universities on a bunch of things, including kind of the rules of basketball and things like that, but also on the rule that you can't pay student athletes, which is apparently a term that the NCAA made up in part to kind of avoid scrutiny from people advocating for workers' rights. But the rule that you can't pay student athletes more than can giving them kind of certain kinds of scholarships and a little bit of money for food and stuff like that. You can't pay them anything.
So now you can pay them a little bit more.
Yeah.
So here the case begins with a, you know, major lawsuit in federal court where the groups of players were asking for a bunch of these rules to be set aside on the grounds that they violate the Sherman Act. And the district court opinion was kind of a mixed bag. It did not open up the kind of like big compensation coffers, but it did say some of the NCAA's limits on how much student athletes can get paid, especially for room and board and internships. You know, the NCAA regulates everything.
And certain kinds of additional scholarships, like vocational scholarships.
Yeah. Some of these went too far.
Yeah.
And so the NCAA, because it doesn't like being told that it's done anything wrong, went to the Supreme Court to say, no, we've got to be able to have these limits. And I think, I mean, as I remember the argument, the limits involved in this case are not the biggest amount of money or the biggest deal, although they're important to the players. But I take it part of the reason the NCAA was concerned is because this opens the door.
Yeah.
This opens the door.
And interestingly, the players in the lower court, they challenged on appeal the denial of their injunction for the bigger problem, like the limits on compensation more generally. But they didn't pursue that in the court. They kind of took a more defensive tack. It looks like that was probably a smart strategy. I don't know if that made the difference, but it seems like it certainly didn't hurt given how this case is going to come out.
Well, so antitrust is not my area, although my impression before this case was argued was The way this works is, as a legal realist matter, the NCAA gets a special exception from the Sherman Act that's not written into law and that nobody can really justify, but the justices don't want to change the nature of college sports. And I think the NCAA may have thought that's how it works too. And there's some previous decisions the NCAA has won on kind of like thin legal grounds. So I think they marched in here thinking they could just say, look, if we take the Sherman Act seriously, you know, the next thing you know, college basketball players might be making huge pro salaries and that the Supreme Court would be horrified at that. But it's not what happened.
Yeah. And so historically, I think if you go back a couple of generations, you see the court was way more deferential to sports leagues and antitrust cases. And you have these cases in baseball, recognizing that baseball is the special exemption from antitrust across the board, which the rationale being, as I understand it, that baseball is not a business, it's a pastime, which is nonsense.
I think the rationale was that baseball games are not interstate commerce because while you play baseball games all over the country, you only play any given baseball game in one state.
Yeah. That was maybe the original one. And then Flood versus Kuhn, there's this opinion by Justice Blackmun. I think only one other person joined that the relevant part where he like just writes this really long list of baseball players who are really great. So I think that like,
do you hate America, Dan?
I like baseball. I like baseball players. But more recently, I think the court has sort of started to say, like, let's be a little bit real about this. In one case that gets cited, a case from about a little bit more than a decade ago was American Needle, where the various NFL teams had sort of made an agreement about licensing merchandise, and American Needle, which wanted to sell merchandise and get licensing deals from individual teams, sort of said this is an illegal restraint on trade. And NFL marched into court and made this super aggressive argument that basically, you know, we have, even though the teams are separate legal entities and owned separately, you know, we just have this categorical exemption that we should be treated as a single entity. And the court was like, no, I don't think so. I think we got to do some rule of reason analysis on that. And then similarly here, where it takes a look at this and is like, no, you're not automatically going to be exempted just by virtue of what you do. Now, one other thing about the majority before we get to the merits is it has, you know, a number of pages of kind of history of college sports, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah. So people like to make fun of the court when it does this, where it just like goes on like a lark about, you know, it finds them interesting. And I think people like to make fun of Justice Gorsuch all the time. Did this bother you, or did you like the history of the Harvard-Yale boat race?
I like this. I thought this is interesting. I thought, you know, if it had gone on any longer, I would have had a problem with it. But I thought this was enough. I mean, and I thought it was interesting because it did feel relevant, because one thing he talks about is how historically this has been a big business kind of for a long time. And there actually was a lot of influence of money and college sports, you know, kind of very early on. I wasn't aware of all these facts, or basically college teams like a century ago were like hiring these ringers and like having them transfer in for like a week and things like that. So I thought that was interesting. I liked it.
Yeah, me too.
We're going to go on and talk about what happens. And so as I understand it, kind of the NCAA's basic argument is, yes, there's a lot of consensus in the case about like what the relevant market is and the fact that these agreements are in some sense anti-competitive with respect to the labor market. But the NCAA's argument seems to be, well, this is really critical because we have to have these agreements because it differentiates us from other kinds of sports. And so it's like gives consumers more choices, because if we started paying players anything, would make everyone think the college sports are just like every other sport and not want to watch us rather than the NBA or the NFL anymore. I think that's sort of what they're saying, which strikes me as just honestly laughable.
Why laughable? I do think there is this, sometimes in these antitrust cases, we take a step back and say, you know, yes, looked at a micro level, what you're doing is anti-competitive because you're making it harder for, you know, individual schools to compete for players. But at a macro level, you're making it easier for consumers to have two different choices of what kind of game to watch. And if the NBA and NCAA basketball are more different, that gives consumers more choices. And isn't that what we care about most? Why is that silly?
Well, I guess I find it silly, you know, for some of the reasons that Justice Kavanaugh is going to talk about, which we'll get to, but also just as the, I can't remember if it's the majority or the Kavanaugh opinion notes. I mean, there already is a huge amount of money flowing into the people involved in these games. Like the coaches are making $10 or $11 million a year in some instances. The athletic directors are making a huge amount of money. And so just, it strikes me as preposterous. The idea that like the fact that the athletes aren't making any money is the key thing that's causing people to watch the games. I don't think that that would change if we started letting players get paid. Certainly it would not change if we started letting players get paid for like vocational scholarships and like post-grad internships, which is what was at issue here.
Well, we'll find out. But here's the part I think is not silly. I think is that the rationale, this rationale that the reason people love to watch the NCAA is because the athletes don't get paid. I think that is the rationale that supports the broader restrictions against paying student athletes and all.
I don't like those either though.
Well, neither does Kavanaugh. So I think the one point the NCAA does have is that the majority pretends, oh, don't worry, this is just a little bit of money for vocational training. It's not letting star players get paid $1 million a year.
But they don't purport to be resolving that. They just sort of say that's out of the case for right now.
Maybe they are. I guess what I mean is if you don't buy this rationale now, maybe that's fine. But I think we may have just started sliding down the slope.
Well, you're saying that we're going to ultimately go where Justice Kavanaugh is going to go.
Yeah, rejecting the NCAA's argument here logically leads to where Justice Kavanaugh is going to go.
And yeah,
we should be happy about that or sad about that, but we should know that's where we're going.
And so let's explain that. But I guess just the last thing to say about what the majority is doing, it's sort of saying like on its own terms, this justification you're offering just isn't good enough to get you, at least prevent any review of this. These things have to be subject to the rule of reason. And the district court did that. And this was basically reasonable. Right. Okay. Yeah. And that brings us, I don't think I have a ton else to say about the majority, but that brings us to the Justice Kavanaugh opinion. You know, of course, Justice Kavanaugh was going to write something in a big sports law case. He's a big sports fan or of a baseball fan, as I recall from the confirmation where before things got really crazy, one of the earlier scandals was, you know, who paid for his baseball tickets or whatever. I don't remember.
He coaches basketball though, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he coaches his daughter's team. So he's a fan of a lot of sports, but I think he's thought a lot about this. And he wrote an opinion that struck me as quite persuasive and probably correct, where he basically says, yeah, I agree with all this, but I also think NCAA, you are in real trouble with respect to all the other things you're restricting. Basically, I think you need to allow student athletes to get paid for real. And let me just kind of give you a really quick version of what that argument looks like. And you all should be on notice. Maybe you should get on top of this.
Yeah. The NCAA must supply a legally valid pro-competitive justification for its remaining compensation rules. And as I see it, the NCAA may lack such a justification. Goes through, you know, I love this. He goes through the sort of amateurism, these various arguments that the previous of the court, and this is the funny part, previous of the court, I think, would have accepted these at face value. And now, just as Kavanaugh is walking through, you know, the NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America. A restaurant can't come together to cut cooks' wages on the theory that customers prefer to eat from low-paid cooks. Law firms cannot conspire to cabin lawyers' salaries in the name of providing legal services out of a love of the law. Hospitals cannot agree to cap nurses' income in order to create a purer form of helping the sick. News organizations cannot join forces to curtail pay to reporters to preserve a tradition of public-minded journalism. Movie studios cannot collude to slash benefits to camera crews to kindle a spirit of amateurism in Hollywood. Price-fixing labor is price-fixing labor.
He's got a point, right?
He does have a point.
I thought that was quite persuasive. He also has kind of raises some distributional concerns, notes that there's a lot of money flowing to college sports, but it's all going to people at the top. It's not going to the athletes. And he notes many of whom are African-American. So I don't know. There's a lot to like here, whether you're a sports fan or labor and employment law.
So one tricky thing, which he does acknowledge, is that, and that makes his analogies, I think, a little weaker, is that playing college sports is a thing that many people do for free, and some people do for a huge, you know, we get a huge amount of money for it. So if we do go down Justice Kavanaugh's road, thinking through how this is going to work with respect to Title IX, where the money is different across men's sports and women's sports, for better or worse, and that does seem to be partly a reflection of customer preferences, although those are in turn shaped by all the choices the industry makes. And again, you have some people who would happily pay for free and some wouldn't, in a way that's not necessarily true of like the cooks. There aren't like, it isn't like you have a million people like who just decide to work as a line cook for free and then a few people who are amazing line cooks who make millions of dollars at it.
Although you do have people who cook at home for free and people who, I don't know.
But I only cook for my friends. I don't cook for strangers.
You never cooked for me.
Well,
I don't know what that says. Another thing, I mean, so I agree there would be a lot to, if they go that route, there would be a lot of fallout, a lot of things to work out. And then another moving piece here is states are legislating in this area. And some states have passed legislation that says schools are not allowed to prevent athletes from, you know, getting money for like licensing their likenesses and getting endorsements and things like that. And that's NCAA is having to deal with that. So the ground is really shifting here. I think it just sort of seems like a lot of people have started saying like, come on, this is ridiculous. You got to pay these folks something. And so, you know, I think this may kind of speed things up on that front a little bit more.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, there's this passage at the end of Kavanaugh's opinion where he notes, you know, we don't have to do this in litigation. Legislation would be one option. Or colleges and student athletes could engage in collective bargaining or negotiated agreements to work this out. No, we got to do something. Are you optimistic that either of those things is going to happen, that legislation is going to happen, or that the NCAA is going to read this opinion and get out in front of it? Or do you think they're just going to like hold on white knuckled until a court?
I think we might see more state level legislation. I don't think that we're necessarily going to see any federal legislation, you know, for reasons we've already mentioned, that there just isn't that much.
What about just agreement? Like, could the NCAA get this and say, okay, guys, I guess we got to get real?
I think that it's really hard to get people to voluntarily give up a lot of money. And the schools, you know, the NCAA is run by schools. It's not run by the players. And they're going to push back on having to suddenly, you know, pay athletes, especially given that it's like, do you pay them unlimited amounts? Like, does Duke pay its college basketball players $5 million a year? And then the Gonzagas of the world can't compete anymore. I mean, there's some hard questions there. I think it would be wise for the NCAA to start getting out in front of this because they clearly are in a place that is way behind public opinion, I think, and now also increasingly way behind where the law is. But whether they do that, or just keep fighting. It does seem like there is, you know, I saw this in the American Needle case. I've seen this other places, this sense among lawyers who represent sports leagues that, you know, we can do whatever we want. Like, this is, you know, the good old days. Courts are just blindly deferred. Maybe they haven't quite gotten the memo. I hope they get the memo after this opinion, especially given, you know, the last line of Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence. The NCAA is not above the law. So, you know, he's not messing around here. And I don't know whether everybody else agrees with him, but I mean, nobody concurred to say he's wrong.
Right. The majority didn't really disagree with him. They just didn't take a position.
Yeah.
I mean, my guess is that the NCAA will do basically nothing. They will end up back in court. They will lose. And the Supreme Court will ultimately issue an opinion that quotes heavily from Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence here.
And we'll talk about it.
Yeah. So if the NCAA lawyers had only been listening to the show now, we could save them a lot of money.
Yeah. And we are available, NCAA, for consultation. Reasonable rates. I think that's all we have to say about the opinions. We're not going to talk about this Goldman Sachs Group case. Some interesting securities fraud stuff there, but a little bit outside of our core areas of interest. And we want to preserve your attention span because there's going to be plenty more covering in the next week or so. So anything else? Do we have any feedback we want to talk about, Will?
A lot of our feedback we're getting has been great, and I think we'll probably do some roundup on it once the term is over. I just have to briefly note, you know, last episode, we talked about the possibility that the court was using some kind of like stare decisis overturning avoidance in its decision in Fulton versus Philadelphia, where they were deciding, they were interpreting things a little creatively to avoid having to get into whether to overturn employment diversion versus Smith. Reader, just a note pointing to one of Justice Barrett's articles as a law professor, in which she proposes the idea of the stare decisis avoidance canon, in which the court would do more or less what it's done in Fulton. So maybe she's the brains behind the operation. I don't know. That's all.
Quite possible. Yeah. And I'd read that article a while back, but that concept had already faded from my memory. So I thought that was a great comment. It's like, oh, this thing that you talked about already exists and one of the justices has already written about it. But I was like, oh, okay. Probably should have remembered that. So thank you. And I think that's all we got. So you want to lead us out, Will?
Thanks for listening. Thanks to all the people who have made this show possible and sent in feedback. Please stay tuned during the last busy week of the court. We are looking forward to what comes next.
I am too. And please keep sending us feedback, pod@dividedargument.com. Check out our merchandise we're selling, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, and the like. That's at store.dividedargument.com. And please, if you have time, give us a rating and a review on the Apple Podcast app. That helps people find the show. It's still the main place that people discover podcasts, and it will boost our listenership. Our listenership is growing, but we want it to grow even further. We want it to grow so much further that we actually become an illegal monopoly that will be subject to antitrust scrutiny, much as the NCAA now is.
We're not above the law.